Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
A search for the truth behind an international drug smuggling plot.
How are we going to unravel this all?
From the BBC World Service, this is World of Secrets, Season 5, Finding Mr. Fox. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. We'll be talking in a moment about the horrific flooding that struck Spain in recent days, but also about the changing patterns of climate disasters more generally in this warming world.
These events together have resulted in more than 570,000 deaths. And we found that in all of these events, climate change made the event more likely and more intense.
And there are further developments in the threat of H5N1 bird flu in the USA, with new evidence of how easily it could become transmissible between people.
This is a mutation that frequently arises in mammals when avian viruses grow in mammalian cells. And it's a mutation that allows the virus to grow more efficiently in mammalian cell types.
Another week, another example of how vulnerable we are to weather extremes. The pictures from Spain of the flooding there these past days are truly shocking. 630 millimetres of rain in a day recorded at one station just south of Valencia. That's almost two-thirds of a tonne of water dropped on every square metre that then gushes into the valleys below, sweeping all before it. And as I write this script, the Spanish forecasters have issued another red warning as the stationary weather pattern drags yet more moist air in from the overheated ocean surface. Such weather patterns have set in the past. Indeed, they're important in bringing water to a generally arid region. But are they changing? Ana Camarosa Belmonte is a climate historian based in Valencia who's been asking that precise question.
For example, in 1957, the most of the rainfall was concentrated on the coast. And now the system, the main convective system, is entering a bit in inland. And it has been feedback of humidity from the sea. And it has been maintained high intensities during long time. I mean, when you have a high intensity, it's not usual to be maintained for such a long time. It's a synergy of bad elements.
Because you've done a paper looking at the change in extreme patterns. And there is a change, is there, going on in the past decades?
In general, yes, but only in relationship with this event, because I have studied intensity in comparison of rainfall in comparison with accumulate. And if we can understand intensity as risk and rainfall accumulated as a resource, and there has been a change of a pattern inland where there are the headwaters, when the rainfall is very productive because we have the dams for store them. In this case, the resource is being more and more decreasing. And on the contrary, in the coast, when our people live in, the intensity, this is the risk, the intensity is being increasing. So we are in a change. Events are more and more intense on the coast where the people are living. So the pattern is changing from resource to risk in the Mediterranean coast. So it's very, very important because we have the same. We have the resource and the risk. And the spatial pattern is being changed and the resource is being decreasing when in the part, in the headwater, when it should be stored, and the risk is being increasing when people leave.
It sounds like global warming could be affecting you in two ways. One, you're getting longer droughts, longer heat waves, you're getting less rain for the agriculture and for giving people water.
Yeah.
But when it does rain, it's more intense.
Yes.
And it's in the wrong place.
Yes, yes. And the hydrological system, with high intensity, is being accelerated. But not only is a question of climate change, it's a question on land use planning, because we are occupying all the flood plain. Even though now we have flood maps,
yeah,
and they are developing this in this century, and we know the areas prone to be inundated. But now we need planning, urbanistic planning, because this is a big problem too. There are a lot of areas that are being occupied by urbanization, and the soils are being more and more impermeable. And now we need to look forward solutions based on nature, more environmental solutions, and the educational solution in order to act over the vulnerability and resilience of the society instead of the hazard.
The disaster this week was in Valencia, your hometown. Next week or next month, it will be another city. What is your message to other cities who know they could be at risk and maybe don't understand how serious that risk is?
My message is to follow absolutely what the administration and this emergency service are saying by mass media, because they are saying to stay at home, not to go out. And I see people that go to the bridge to take photos, to take videos, to make themselves on risk. And I think that this is because people don't know how it works. And so we need to teach them about the risk. And most of all, they must follow the advices of the emergency services.
And in terms of planning for the future?
Scientists and technical people, we have done what we must do. I mean, we have studied, we know the problem, but now that must be transferred to as a strategy of land use and as education for society, because we know the problem. Now that must be transferred.
Anna Camarasa of the University of Valencia. She mentioned people reacting dangerously to the sudden floods rather than making themselves safe in a timely manner. And I've kept wondering this year how most of us could appreciate the imminent surge of water a persistent storm can generate when we've really never seen anything like it before. The role of our imagination is something flood expert Jess Newman of Reading University has been researching, with interviews with victims of other sudden European floods in recent years. Her findings are important, but I asked her first to share more details of the weather system that brought disaster to Valencia.
So what we've seen in the past couple of days in southern and eastern Spain is a weather phenomena which is known as Dana, or D-A-N-A. And this is not something that is unusual in the area. However, of course, the unprecedented amount of rainfall that has fallen is very much unusual. And what's actually happening is cool air from the north is being drawn across the warmer Mediterranean waters. And essentially what happens is this cool air tries to push up and push away the warm air. And this increases the moisture being held in the atmosphere. You get these storm clouds developing and intense storms and heavy rainfall. Now, what we've actually seen here is the jet stream high up in the atmosphere. It can meander like a river. And what can happen is it creates a cutoff area of low pressure. And essentially, this has stalled a regenerating storm system over this part of Spain, and particularly the Valencia region.
I mean, as I saw it from the pictures, you've got this sort of low pressure high up in the atmosphere, this bit of the jet stream that's sort of peeled off almost. And then that's just sort of drawing in the air over the ocean, over the both, I think, the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. I'm not sure, but that's just, and then it's just sucking up over that one part of Spain and just dropping the rainfall day after day.
That's exactly it. So the Mediterranean this year particularly, we've had records broken in terms of sea surface temperatures. So the sea, the water is very warm. We've got this cool air coming in from the north, and it's literally, as you say, sucking up the energy and the moisture from the warm sea. And the area that's been affected is fairly mountainous as well, and this is sort of perpetuating the formation of these storm clouds and rainfall, and all of this coming together is so to create this sort of perfect storm.
That's what's happened this week in Valencia. Other weeks it's been, I don't know, we've just been talking about not so long ago about Storm Helene, Hurricane Helene in North Carolina. This keeps on happening. And the thing that really interests me is not whether it happens, but how people can appreciate beforehand how catastrophic this can be. It's beyond imagination is part of the trouble for me.
It's very interesting you've just used that term, beyond imagination, because some of the research we've been doing at Reading is very much about imagination and the fact that when you have these huge events, these very devastating events, you know, people can't imagine what it's like to be faced with a 3 meter high wall of water coming towards your property. And this isn't something, as we know, sadly, it's not just Spain that's been affected. We had the floods of Europe a few years ago. We've had Helene and other hurricanes recently. You know, this is a global issue. And a lot of what we are going to need to be doing going forward is helping people to hopefully imagine what it could be like. And you know, for most people, we hope this would never happen. But being prepared in case the worst does happen is where we need to be. And at the moment, we're not there. And this is partly why we're seeing, unfortunately, so many deaths as a result of these sort of storms, because people aren't getting the warnings. And if they are getting the warnings, a lot of the time, they don't know what to do with them. And understandably, because we're not actually telling people really what it means when we get storm events like this.
I mean, one of the things that Anna Camarasa said to me just after we were doing the chit-chat bit of an interview, so it wasn't recorded, but she was saying how when the gullies and the dry riverbed started filling up, people went out to look what was going on rather than taking protective action. And this must happen again and again, because a 1 in 20 year event, you just don't realise until it's too late the danger that's present.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, we see it with things like tsunami, for example, where, you know, the sea starts to retreat and people are watching it. I think it must be something to do with human nature that when something like these sort of hazards happen and something out of the ordinary, we're almost drawn to look at them and to try and process and understand what's happening.
I mean, does your research point to what kinds of education can be done? You know, we have fire drills in Japan, they have tsunami drills in the States, they have earthquake drills. Is it practical, given how rare these flood events are, to do something similar?
I think it's absolutely practical because, you know, like you said, we have earthquake drills, we have tsunami drills, we have volcano drills, and in most of Europe, thankfully, these are not issues that we have to face. But our biggest issue is flooding, and it does kill people. And as we've seen over the past few years, this isn't something that is just happening now and again. It's happening every few years to a huge degree, and we're seeing loss of life. And actually, even just educating from a young age about not only how does flooding happen, but how do we prepare for it, taking it that next step, is really critical to kind of embed that in people's knowledge, because people just, and we see it in the UK, people just don't know, unfortunately, unless they're given an evacuation warning, they don't know how to prepare for flooding in a lot of cases. And it does take people by surprise. And that's what we need to address.
Is there something we can do to, I mean, if we don't have to accept this, though, do we? I mean, it's not only a question of tackling global warming, but as Anna said to me, authorities can plan better, they can build better.
Yes, I completely agree with Anna there. At the moment, our urban areas, typical across a lot of Europe, for example, they're not designed to cope with even moderate amounts of rainfall. What we're talking about in Spain, a year's worth of rainfall in 8 hours, no urban area is going to be able to absorb that and cope with it. And this is unprecedented in that sense. But for some of these, I use the term more minor floods, but obviously they're very, very significant to the people who are affected by them. Better management, better design of our urban areas and how we work with water is absolutely imperative if we're going to have any chance of making communities safer and feel more prepared in where they live. And that can be, it sounds radical, but I've said before about this idea of in floodplains, houses on stilts, and people laugh, but actually this might be where we're headed, or the way in which we design our properties on aquifibious foundations and things like that. It's going to be the way we're going to have to go in the future, because storms and flooding of this nature is not something that's going to go away.
Climate scientist Jess Newman with some sound advice. And already the scientists at the World Weather Attribution Collaboration have calculated that the rainfall over Valencia was about 12% heavier and twice as likely compared with what we might have expected before global warming. Time and again, this young collaboration has found the imprint of ongoing global warming all over destructive storms and heat waves in recent years. They were founded a decade ago to say whether a particular weather extreme had been affected by rising global temperatures. Most often it has. In an anniversary paper this week, they revisit some of the worst disasters that they've analysed and take a fresh look at earlier episodes, revealing the true human cost of climate change this century. Here's project leader Freddie Otto.
We founded World Weather Attribution 10 years ago because basically every time an extreme weather event happened, people had questions about the role of climate change, but no one from the scientific community would give an answer or a satisfactory answer. And so, therefore, we started to do these attribution studies and assess the role of climate change in extreme weather events. And at the beginning, we really had to still develop a lot of the methodologies and therefore focused very much on, like most scientists do, on the events that happened at our doorstep, so European events and events that got a lot of attention in the global media. But now that we have expanded quite dramatically our network in different parts of the world, and also the methodology is now much better to capture more complex events like droughts and tropical cyclones, we went back to see, okay, in this century, what were the deadliest events and what can we say now about them that we might not have been able to say when they are occurred? And so we looked at the 10 deadliest events since the very first attribution study was published. And in the databases that are available, these events together have resulted in more than 570,000 deaths. And we found that in all of these events, climate change made the event more likely and more intense. Of course, that doesn't mean that every single death in these events is because of climate change, but climate change significantly increased the impacts and made them worse. And so many of these deaths would have not happened without climate change.
I mean, one of those that you went back to study again was the cyclone Nargis back in 2008. So that was sort of when the science of doing this was incredibly fresh, but also it's sort of, 16 years back in terms of the amount of CO2. But even that one, you're saying, with 138,000 dead, you're saying that you could see the fingerprint looking back of climate change in that.
Yes. So that is another thing that that we did, that we analyzed some of these events, and including Cyclone Nargis, pretending we are still in 2008 and only had 0.9 degrees of global warming. And even with that warming, we did see an increase in the wind speeds that were associated. And that, of course, played a role in the storm surge that was particularly deadly, and also in the rainfall. We also did this, for example, with the Russian heat wave. That was another very deadly event that happened in 2010 and was actually studied quite a lot at the time, where we found that this event, if we're pretending again we were in the year 2010, we found that climate change made the event 83 times more likely. But if the same event, if it would be at the time already 1.3 degree warmer, so being in 2025, it would be 140 times more likely. So you can see that the last 14 years of climate change really made a huge difference again in terms of how much more likely these types of events have become.
It seems to me so incredibly important to tie the weather, which is what happens, I think someone famously said, to the changes in climate, which is sort of the background conditions, to pinpoint that, yeah, these things really are changing, and you're able, with your modern techniques, to do this, you know, within a week or two.
Yes, we are. And that is why, I mean, that is the whole reason why we founded World Weather Attribution, because we thought it is incredibly important to understand what climate change means, to bring our experience of it, which is in weather extremes, together with the much more abstract science of climate change. Because it's all very well to say, well, greenhouse gas emissions lead to higher temperatures, and we already have now a global mean temperature of 1.3 degrees. But of course, global mean temperatures don't kill anyone. It is how these global mean temperatures affect extreme weather events that actually kill people and lead to people losing their livelihoods.
I mean, one of the points you make early on in the paper is it's not just the immediate impacts, so the number of people who may be killed or injured in these events or harmed in some way, but the long-term impacts on the recovery, on the state of the economy afterwards. These events are actually costing economies in a huge way.
Yes, they are. And I mean, we have seen this year, we've just seen two hurricanes back to back hitting the US. And we know that even in a rich country like the US, it will take years, to rebuild this. And on the first hurricane, Hurricane Helene, the FEMA, so the early responding agency in the US, had used up half of their annual budget. And the financial year had just started, so just within the first days. So if there will be another hurricane like this later in the season, they will just not have enough funds to actually help people in the way, and that's in the US. And I think in our paper, we see this most strongly in the Horn of Africa, where there have been repeated droughts and floods over the last few decades. And not all of them have a strong signature of climate change, but some of the droughts and some of the floods were more intense. And that means that a region that's already very vulnerable and struggling with these compounding events, the increase in just some of them adds up and makes it really, really hard for the region to increase resilience, let alone increase adaptation, because it's so hard to just cope with the events when they come.
I mean, you also mentioned in the paper the 2022 floods in Pakistan, where you say that the national poverty rate may have been increased by 4.3%, millions of extra people in poverty because of the damage done by that. And that sets everything back. It sets the infrastructure, the resilience back, and all of it.
Yes. I mean, this is really, I mean, the main takeaway message from having done this for the last 10 years for me is that the major impact of human-induced climate change is that it increases inequality. In every city, in every country, climate change increases inequality and therefore, of course, intensifies all the problems that come with inequality. So climate change and inequality are intrinsically linked, and we cannot combat climate change or adapt to it without addressing other sources of inequality.
You mentioned very early on in the paper a commentary by another climate scientist, Miles Allen, published in 2003. I don't know if it was the direct inspiration or whether it sort of just fitted in with your thinking, but what struck me was he says, will it ever be possible to sue anyone for damaging the climate? And when I see the costs of what's going on at the moment, it does seem to me that liability is a really important part. Is that still part of your plan?
I mean, I wouldn't say that it's part of the plan, but it's definitely something that we see happening. And this paper that you mentioned by Miles Allen, that basically was the inspiration for the methodology that we are still, although we have changed it and improved it a lot, but the methodology that we are still using, which comes from epidemiology. So he said, in the same way that we can sue a tobacco company for increasing the cancer risk in people, in the same way, should we not be able to sue fossil fuel companies for all the damages they cause because of their business model of selling fossil fuels that have no other usage than being burned and leading to climate change. And we have actually seen an increasing number of litigation cases that use this argument. And there's one ongoing in Germany at the moment where RWE, so the biggest German emitter, is sued by a victim of climate change. And we see an increasing number of these litigation cases to occur. And of course, we don't do attribution just because it's useful in litigation, but I think it is one important lever that we as a civil society have to try and speed up meaningful climate policy.
Freddie Otto of the World Weather Attribution Project, who will inevitably be back on Science in Action again after another extreme weather event.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and the Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Climate change keeps barging into the programme. But so too does the threat from the alarming H5N1 strain of bird flu. It's over 6 months since we first talked about the way the avian virus crossed over into cattle on US dairy farms. There's been no slowing of its spread, and the number of farm workers also being infected keeps growing too, though mostly with eye infections, presumably from splashed droplets, and none too seriously. But two papers rushed online by the journal Nature report experiments from one of these cases showing the virus does have or can evolve quickly the capacity to move easily between people. Virologist Amy Eisfeld, who talked to Science in Action in July, was involved in the research.
So the virus that we used in this study was isolated from a farm worker in Texas that was working with infected dairy cattle. It came from an eye swab from this individual. So it's basically a bovine H5N1 that was taken from a human.
And you have then taken it into your labs. Now, you've tested it in a whole bunch of ways, which I find quite interesting. One of those is you tested that with human lung cells. Is that right?
So we did, yes. We looked at its ability to grow in alveolar cells, which are the cells that are deep in the lung. And we found that it replicated to high levels. The amount of virus that we were able to get out of that cell type exceeded 10 million infectious viruses over a course of 96 hours. When you compare that to an isolate that was taken from a lactating dairy cow, we have about 100-fold decreased amount of virus. So in other words, this virus that was isolated from a human grows much more efficiently in human cells compared to an isolate that was taken from a cow.
So that's suggesting there's already some kind of adaptation is there that in the virus when it's moved from the infectious cows into this particular farm worker.
So, yeah, it has a mutation called PB2627K. This is a mutation that frequently arises in mammals when avian viruses grow in mammalian cells. And it's a mutation that allows the virus to grow more efficiently in mammalian cell types.
So it's what happens to the virus after it's got into the cells. It replicates faster, effectively.
That's correct.
Okay. And you also tried infecting mice and ferrets. Explain that.
By looking in mice, we can do an experiment that gives us a lethal dose, which we can use to compare to other viruses that are either very similar or very different. And in the context of the mouse experiments, we found that the lethal dose that was required to kill half of the animals that were infected was less than one infectious unit. And compared to the bovine isolate that we previously published about, that one had a lethal dose of 30 infectious units. So this human isolate is more lethal in the mouse model. And it also spread to every tissue that we looked in very efficiently as well. So it was in the respiratory tract and then also in the non-respiratory tissues.
And is it more lethal simply because it's replicating better, or is there more to it?
So most likely it has to do a lot with that PB2627K mutation, but there may be additional factors that are contributing to this because other viruses also possess that mutation and don't have the same kind of lethal dosage. So there's probably other factors that are contributing to this as well.
I mean, give me a sense then how quickly you've been doing these experiments. It sounds like you think that what you've got so far is in itself pretty important.
Yeah, so it was important, I think, to get this information out because actually, so you asked also about the ferret experiments. And really, when we're talking about these bovine viruses that have the potential to infect humans, what we're really worried about is whether or not the viruses can transmit by aerosol droplets. And our previous work suggested that this could occur inefficiently with bovine isolates, but this isolate that was taken from a human actually transmitted in every experiment that we did with it. It wasn't 100% transmission, but we saw between 17 and 33% transmission in all of the cases in which we tested it.
But I guess the alarming point is that in this particular case, it sounds like it is transmissible and risky, and at the very least, that means it can happen again.
Yeah, this mutation occurs in mammals over and over and over again. So the likelihood that it could occur again is out there. I do have to say, though, that there have been more than 30 individuals that have presented with illness related to this bovine H5N1 outbreak in the United States. And the viruses that were isolated from those individuals, we haven't found this PB2627K yet. So I don't want to be too alarming. This is something that has occurred in one incident. We haven't seen it again, but yes, it definitely could occur again. And with, you know, additional mutations, it may acquire the ability to transmit more efficiently.
You said that with the mice, you found it in a wide range of tissues. Did that include nervous tissues, neural tissues?
Yeah, it does. We consistently found virus in the brain in all of the animals that we examined. And actually, it's the same in the ferrets, too. So in ferrets, we find virus spread systemically. It's in the bloodstream. It goes to the brain. It also goes to places like the liver, the spleen, the kidney, the heart, as well as the respiratory tissues that we classically think of as being affected by influenza virus.
Going forwards, I suppose what I see a lot of experts saying is there simply isn't enough testing and sampling going on. I mean, if there were more testing and sampling, would you be able to give us a better picture?
Yeah, so there is some active surveillance among dairy workers, and you may also know that there have been some spillover infections into chicken farms. The individuals who are responsible for culling those animals, there is surveillance among them, and we are finding virus. If we did more surveillance, we would find more. So yeah, if we were doing more testing, then we would have a better idea of how widespread this is and what the actual threat or risk really is to us.
Amy Eisfeld from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a hub of flu research. just after I recorded that interview, the US health agencies reported a case of pigs infected by H5N1. Pigs are notorious mixing vessels for cooking up new variants of flu, so that is another worrying sign. Though these ones got the virus direct from birds rather than from cattle, so it's not quite the same subtype we were just talking about. Obviously, we'll keep an eye on developments here on Science in Action from the BBC World Service. But for now, that's it for this edition. I'm Roland Pease. The producer is Alex Mansfield. Thanks for listening.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news, with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.